Alex Diamond, you've been on the Old Mole before, but remind us, what's your work? What are you doing in Colombia?
Well, I've spent about 3 years total living in a Colombian village that gets called the Peace Laboratory. It's Briceño, Antioquia, that has been a key area for the implementation of Colombia's peace process, which was signed in 2016 with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or the FARC. So I've been researching basically what this peace process has meant as part of a larger transformation for this village, which includes transitioning away from a coca economy, coca being the raw material for cocaine, and it also includes Colombia's largest hydroelectric dam.
Researching and writing about those issues. How does the election fit into all that? And what significance do you find in the victory of Petro and Marquez?
So I started my research in this village in 2018, which was Colombia's last election, which was a tremendous disappointment for last presidential election, which was a tremendous disappointment for many people because the winner was Iván Duque, who represented a return to the past. He was sort of put in power by Álvaro Uribe, who's kind of the boogeyman of Colombian politics, known for paramilitary support, human rights violations, right-wing economic policies. In that election, Petro, Colombia's new president, came in second, which was actually historic because it was the first time that a left-wing candidate had even arrived to the runoff election. But in the 4 intervening years, the president, Iván Duque, who's now out the door, dismantled the peace process as he promised to do, or at least as much as he could. He defunded it. He pushed the country to more militarization. He continued the path, what gets called neoliberal reform, including lots of foreign investment, lots of extractivist mining, petroleum projects. And essentially, for an already pretty significant population of poor people in Colombia, life got much harder. So with Petro, there's, I think, a tremendous hope and justified hope that the country will become more equal, but also that the peace process will be reclaimed.
In Colombia, the phrase they use is Petro en Francia, last name and first name for the president and the vice president. This came about through what they call an historic pact, Pacto Histórico. Tell us about that. Who's part of it? How likely is it to stay together?
So there was a tremendous, and still is a tremendous, framing from the Pacto Histórico, which is this political group that has developed that this is, and it's accurate. This is the first time in Colombian history that there has been an alternative to either the traditional parties, which was for all of Colombian history until the beginning of the 21st century, either liberals or conservatives, both of which were pretty conservative, frankly. The break with that was to the right. So this is the first time there's been any sort of leadership on the left, and their framing was this is an historic moment. And also, and I think this is accurate, Petro has run before. He ran in 2010 and 2018, but as a more left-wing, slightly more radical candidate. I mean, his background is actually being a member of a guerrilla movement. Not for 30 years, but that's certainly something that was used against him. So this was sort of a reframing that it's not just Petro, it's not just the left, but that they're actually including a lot of more centrist viewpoints, which I think is accurate. Now, even beyond the Pacto Histórico, he's made a number of alliances with the Liberal Party, which I just said is not liberal, however you define liberal, because it is liberal in the in what we think of as the neoliberal sense. But he's absolutely made alliances with more center to even right-wing parties in order to get votes he needs in Congress.
Tough question then. How do you assess that? He's needed to compromise, is what you've just said, in order to be elected, in order to be in the position to do anything. Is he too compromised? Is this going to affect the possibilities for what he can accomplish?
I think this is a really interesting strategic move, because he's clearly, and that this represents a change from 4 years ago when he ran, but it's kind of a real politic approach of softening his stance in ways that some people like me wish, or to some extent wish, that he hadn't done. You know, after being elected, he gave a speech, which was the night of the election, a wonderful speech, that also included, you know, saying very clearly, we're not here to go against capitalism. And then he met with Cesar Gaviria, who's was president of Colombia, like 1990, is known for leading the what's called the apertura, the economic opening of Colombia, Colombia's entry into the age of neoliberalism. And Gaviria proudly made this announcement after their meeting that, you know, we met together, we came to agreements, and I and the Liberal Party have saved capitalism. And Petro didn't say, no, this is not true. What he said repeatedly is, no, I'm not anti-capitalist. We need a capitalism that's that has people's interests and needs in mind. Also, if you look at his appointments of ministers in the government, there are a number of ministers he's appointed that might have been disappointing, people who served in the government of Juan Manuel Santos, who was president from 2010 to 2018, and sort of fit this rhetoric of, no, we're not making these extreme changes, where he was accused of being communist, for example, or socialist even. He said, no, we're not making these extreme changes. We're allying ourselves with more moderate or even right-wing political forces. And the trade-off is that if he didn't do this, you know, he does not have a majority in Congress. And Colombia, a lot of governance actually happens on the margins, and particularly in the areas that are racked by violence. So that's actually something you can see in the village that I live and work in. He's allied himself with these traditional interests who are often corrupt, and they're often they use clientelist relations to maintain power. They use state resources, distribute them to their supporters in order to guarantee continued political support. He's allied himself with all of these groups who do these things in order to be able to push through maybe more limited reforms, but in order to be able to get these reforms done. So I think it's a really interesting sort of looking at his appointments and the tax reform bill that he's pushed through, and a few other things he's done since coming into office. You know, you can see that he actually has thought a lot about, you know, what's the best way to cause change over just a four-year period, going against 200 years of a particular kind of rule in Colombia.
That approach, the compromise, the practical assessment, is being characterized as the new pink tide in Latin America, that it's different from left approach to power, to political power before. After a bit, I want to get talking about Latin America more broadly. I do want to mention at this point, of course, that his choice of running mate was, if anything, to the left of him, if that kind of spectrum makes sense. So social movements in Colombia that his vice president, Francia Márquez, comes very strongly out of. The election, how do you assess the relevance of the street protests that led up to the election the entire prior year in Colombia?
Yes, so I think first it is really important to recognize the importance of Francia Márquez as running mate and now vice president. She's an Afro-Colombian woman who comes out of anti-mining and anti-dam, anti-hydroelectric dam activism from a very poor upbringing in a country where women and Afro-Colombian communities have been tremendously marginalized in politics and in general. And he chose her as a running mate in part because she came in a strong second in their in the primary election that they did with the Pacto Histórico. So she became this tremendously, or she has become a tremendously popular sort of symbolic representation of a marginalized group of Colombian society, which she's referred to as las y los nadies, the nobodies, maybe now having some political voice, where they have been active in social movements, but that have often been repressed by the state. So to bring it full circle and to answer the question you actually asked me, there was tremendous, tremendous social movement activism and street mobilization during the presidency of Iván Duque. And there were sort of these touchstone issues that set off protests, but the protests gathered thousands, tens of thousands, in some cases even hundreds of thousands of people around a number of issues. The most recent one was 2021, which was in response to this tax reform that Duque suggested, that raised taxes on foods that poor and middle-class people depend on to eat, like eggs, for example. That there was this became this huge cultural symbol of the tax minister having no idea, the guy who proposed the reform having no idea in an interview what eggs cost. It would be like me saying now that a dozen eggs cost like 30 cents now, so we're just taxing 20 cents on top of that. So the people made fun of this, but at the same time, it reflected this broader feeling that the government was completely not in touch with the struggles of poor and even middle-class people in Colombian society. But those uprisings, also very much reflected anger about what happened with the peace process, anger about Colombia seeming to again degenerate into violence with armed groups controlling large sections of the countryside and little state investment in these areas. So all of these mobilizations together are, I think, rightly given credit. Petro's candidacy in 2018 was not a beginning, but it was a lot of the same people and same organizations supported him. After he lost in 2018, there were tremendous accusations of fraud. I think that was even part of the mobilizations. It's clear that electoral fraud took place. It's unclear, based on my analysis, whether Petro would have won without the fraud. But this sort of uprising that brought in a number of different specific complaints, Petro's candidacy was sort of part of that, and he was sort of a figure, not that he was the one who organized the protests, but, you know, he's the candidate of that uprising, and sort of everyone knows that. And on the day of his inauguration, he brought in on stage with him the mother of Dylan Cruz, who was killed by Colombian riot police. They were in these uprisings in 2021. There were probably about 200 people killed by Colombian riot police and normal police, just tremendous repression. So he sort of nodded to this movement in a gesture that I think was very respectful, and certainly nothing that anyone in that position of power had ever done in Colombia, by bringing the mother of this protester up and sort of acknowledging this movement that that really did bring him to power.
I've been very impressed between the election and the inauguration. Francia Márquez traveled throughout Latin America, and she met, of course, with political leaders in a number of countries. But in each one of those countries, she met also with the social movements and made a point of emphasizing that that was the constituency that Petro and Márquez, or Petro and Francia, came out of.
Yeah, no, I think just choosing her, because Petro himself, despite his guerrilla backgrounds, has been a part of mainstream Colombian politics for 20-something years, beginning as, even a member of the guerrilla. He was a city council person in Zipaquirá. But yeah, choosing Francia Márquez as his running mate was certainly, and she's internationally famous as an activist, and for using contentious politics. So it's not surprising that she would associate with social movements, but I think it was very clearly a strategic move, and they're maintaining their social bases and looking for allies even in countries that do not have leftist leadership.
point may be obvious, but say a little bit about what they're up against now that they've taken the position as president and the Pacto Histórico is in the parliament.
Well, so they're up against an economy that has collapsed, that is in terrible shape for poor and even middle-class people. Most Colombians do not, the majority of working Colombians do not have formal jobs, which means that in many cases, you know, people are living from selling gum on the bus, or they're, you know, they go to a market and they buy 20 pounds of tomatoes and then break them into 1 pound bags and sell those at limited profit. There are a lot of Colombians, probably most urban Colombians, live off of these kind of just rebusque, it gets called, just a hustle. Even Colombian minimum wage is now, it's less than $250 a month. If you do the conversion, the price of food has gone way up. People are really struggling to live. I think that's the first major challenge that Petro faces as president. For his programs, for the programs that he wants to institute to alleviate that poverty, there isn't, the government doesn't have money to do that. The government is in debt. Debt went up tremendously during Duque's presidency. So that's another challenge. And he's already introduced a tax bill to try to raise that money by taxing the rich more. And that's also a tremendous challenge, is when you think about giving resources to the poor, some level of redistribution, it's basically a zero-sum equation. You have to take from some people to give to others. And the elites of Colombia feel very threatened by Petro. So there was this tremendous discourse of, oh, Petro won, now we have to leave the country. As far as I know, and to my chagrin, because I flew back to the U.S., just a couple days before, maybe 2 days before Petro took office. I'm the only person who actually left right before his inauguration. And not intentionally, not for that reason, for a previous commitment. But yeah, there's fear or thoughts that with new tax structures that elites will pull their money out of Colombia, Colombian elites as well as foreign investment, and that would further weaken the economy.
I can think of a couple of other factors that they're up against, but one of them we have to comment being where we are, and that's the United States response. U.S. has 7 military bases in Colombia, is Colombia's major trading partner, etc. How do you think the U.S. will respond?
So it's a good question, and I think it's a little unclear and will depend a lot on who's the next president of the U.S., obviously. We should note, actually, I would like to give Petro credit for now he's, after saying he was going to do it, now the Colombian National Police have announced that they are no longer going to target coca through forest eradication, which is a fantastic policy decision that goes against U.S. war on drugs rhetoric that has for decades pumped billions of dollars into Colombia and specifically the Colombian military, and has also been just a tremendous focus of U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis Colombia. I think it's worth pointing out that the importance of cocaine in the U.S. has gone down. I think this country now consumes roughly half of what the amount of cocaine that we consumed maybe 20 years ago. And this war on drugs rhetoric, I think there's been more and more pushback from South American governments, led by Evo Morales, of course, in Bolivia. But now, even in Colombia, in the last 10 years, there's been pushback against using glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup to airily fumigate coca crops. And now Petro possibly pushing for decriminalization of coca, and then specifically saying that in terms of interdiction, which is, I think for anybody who follows policy, this is sort of an obvious policy, but that what he wants the military to do is focus on ports and shipping of cocaine, which is the part of the economy that really, one, produces the most amount of money, and two, causes the most violence. And basically to leave farmers be, but give them support to substitute coca for other crops. So this is an example of Petro going pretty directly against what U.S. foreign policy has pushed for in Colombia for decades with all U.S. presidents. Biden was actually one of the authors, I believe, of Plan Colombia, which was the major funding initiative beginning around 2000 that pumped $10 billion of U.S. aid into Colombia with conditions. But it certainly does represent a loss of U.S. influence in Colombia, Colombia being, or having been for decades, the South American country that that has most allowed the U.S. to put soldiers there, and has been the country that really props up U.S. foreign policy in South America. So it remains to be seen how much of a response there's going to be to that. Other reforms that Petro has said that he will engage in will more directly hit the interests of big U.S. corporations. Increased tax, for example, on petroleum extraction, mining. You know, these are a lot of American companies making a lot of money off of foreign trade with Colombia. And he's pretty directly going to attack the bottom line of these companies, he says. So it remains to be seen how the U.S. responds once those policies start taking effect.
And you'll be available to fill us in as we see, right?
Sure, with pleasure. I think it'll be really interesting to see, actually. The signaling from the Biden administration so far has been positive, maybe even more than I would have expected.
Well, one final question, whether you have any reflections that go more broadly than Colombia itself on what, again, is being called a new pink tide in Latin America.
Yeah, so I think this is a really interesting case of trying to think through what real change looks like and how to accomplish it. Even incarnate in Petro, this is a man who joined a revolutionary movement that sought directly to overthrow the state. And the M19 was the revolutionary movement. They disarmed, actually negotiated a change in the constitution, something that we're seeing now in Chile as part of their contribution to the pink tide. But what we see is that, you know, for decades, there was tremendous, at least if you listen to the CIA and U.S. foreign policy, this sort of tremendous fear of a red tide, of revolutionary change. And now it's, you know, through election, politicians like Petro taking power, Lula in Brazil, who seems like he's going to again be president of Brazil in October elections in Brazil, who have these reformist agendas and then are thinking very seriously about, you know, what can they get done making compromises with powerful elite interests. I think Petro is a really interesting test case of this. You know, he softened his stance since he was candidate in 2018. He said, I'm not going to expropriate land. Colombia has tremendous, I think, the highest levels of land inequality in Latin America, most of it through violence from the armed conflict, lands that were stolen. And he previously, and I would support this, said, I'm going to expropriate lands to give to campesinos who have nothing. He's softened that stance very specifically. So yeah, I think there's a specific model for how to create change, thinking realistically, and it'll be interesting to evaluate in 4 years what that's led to in Colombia and also in alliance with other left-wing presidents throughout Latin America, what that means for poor people throughout the region.
We call this part of the old mole, another world is possible. That's what we're going to find out as we monitor what goes on in Latin America and in Colombia. Alex Diamond, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.